You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 14th of April 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up on today's programme, Ukraine's ultimatum to pro-Russian separatists to leave is ignored.
Where are they? The mayor, the government, he says. What are these people? This is madness. I'm not afraid. I built this country. My father fought to defend it. And now they want to drag us back to the Stone Age.
More buildings are seized in the east of the country. James Boyes and James Schneider will give us their views on what happens next. Then, is the Republican Party racist?
I think race has something to do with the fact that they're not bringing up an immigration bill. I've heard them say to the Irish, for just you, this would be easy.
We hear whether claims that President Obama has been treated differently from previous presidents because of his race ring true. Also, we'll check in with our man in Belgrade and we'll review the best art exhibitions in New York City. So, a very busy programme in the next 60 minutes. That's Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. But before we get started on all of that, let's get the latest world news. Here with the bulletin is Jonathan Wheatley.
European Union foreign ministers say the destabilisation of eastern Ukraine is clearly being instigated by Russia as they arrived for a day-long discussion in Luxembourg to discuss the crisis in Ukraine. At the United Nations, Russia's ambassador Vitaly Churkin claimed that violence in Ukraine was the work of Ukrainians and appealed to the Council to use its influence with Ukraine to stop the launch of an anti-terrorist operation. However, America's ambassador to the UN, Samantha Power, said it was hard to reconcile Russia's call for diplomacy in Ukraine with its actions in the region.
It is hard to reconcile the behavior of the Russian Federation, the propaganda of the Russian Federation, the military actions of the Russian Federation, which range from the massing of 40,000 troops on the border to the subversive activities inside Ukraine. It is hard to reconcile those acts with this appeal for diplomacy and de-escalation, an appeal that we wish were in fact sincere.
Meanwhile, pro-Russia activists in the eastern Ukrainian city of Luhansk remain barricaded in the State Security Service building they continue to occupy in the central square. The protesters have said they will lay down their weapons only if Kiev agreed to hold a referendum on the future of the largely Russian-speaking region. A bomb has killed at least 71 people at a Nigerian bus station 5 miles from the capital Abuja. Suspicions fallen on the Islamist group Boko Haram. As well as the 71 dead, police said 124 people were wounded in the first attack on the federal capital in 2 years. The search for the missing Malaysian Airlines flight MH370 is switching from the surface of the Indian Ocean to the seabed. Air Chief Marshal Angus Houston, who's in charge of the search, says an oil slick has been found inside the current search zone off West Australia, and the chances of finding surface wreckage have greatly diminished.
The planned visual search area is about 47,644 square kilometres. The centre of the search area lies approximately 2,200 kilometres northwest of Perth. The air and surface search for floating material will be completed in the next 2 to 3 days in the area where the aircraft most likely entered the water.
Defence lawyers for 5 men accused of conspiring in the September 11, 2001 attacks asked a judge to halt a pre-trial hearing in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, over concerns that FBI agents are investigating them. Earlier this month, two FBI agents approached a defence team member and asked him to sign an agreement, said Jim Harrington, an attorney for Razi bin al-Shib, a Yemeni man accused of wiring money to the 9/11 hijackers. Initial presidential election results in Afghanistan put the opposition figure Abdullah Abdullah in the lead. Results based on 10% of the votes from 26 out of 34 provinces showed Abdullah with 41.9% and the Western-leaning academic Ashraf Ghani second with 37.6%. Ghani said the number of votes counted was too insignificant to be able to draw any conclusion.
We are in a 100-minute game and we've only done the 10 minutes. So as Chairman Nuristani said, the results will change. every day, every 2 days, 3 days.
And finally, politics here in Britain really has gone to the dogs after a Rottweiler was given the right to vote. 8-year-old Zeus got a polling card through the post for the forthcoming European parliamentary election on the 22nd of May. The owner of the dog admitted that when people came round to do a census a while back, he told them, "There's myself, my wife, and we've got Zeus living here as well, and he is 63 in dog years." He didn't realise Zeus would get a polling card rather than his son. And that's the latest news only on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Jonathan Wheatley. Barking mad, you are.
What can I say?
That's Jonathan Wheatley. More news from him. He'll be back with the world news headlines at the bottom of the hour. Right now, though, it's 18:06 here in London. You're with Midori House right here on Monocle 24.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London. 这是 Monocle 24.
Ot London, tu er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Holanda.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. The time here in London, 18:06, 13:06 in New York City. Yeah, joining me now with their take on the news here in Studio One are both James Boyes, author of a new book titled Clinton's Grand Strategy, US Foreign Policy in a Post-Cold War World. And alongside him, James Schneider, editor of Think Africa Press. James's both, welcome.
Thanks for having us.
There they are. Let's turn our attentions to our top story. That is, of course, the ongoing crisis in Ukraine. The country remains on a knife edge. The threat of military action against pro-Russian separatists now a serious possibility. Before I get the views of James Boyes and James Schneider, let's hear from Monocle's Phil Hahn, who filed this report on the day's events.
Tension in Ukraine continued to build Monday as an ultimatum for pro-Russian separatists to leave government buildings came and went. The government in Kiev said a full-scale military operation would be underway if forces did not leave by 7 a.m. But by Monday afternoon, it seemed it was the separatists that had the upper hand. A fresh onslaught in the city of Horlivka saw protesters take over another government building. In Slovyansk, gunfire could be heard as another building was taken over. Tensions also spilled over as citizens loyal to Kiev asked where their government was, as can be heard here during an interview on CNN.
Where are they? The mayor, the government, he says. What are these people? This is madness. I'm not afraid. I built this country. My father fought to defend it. And now they want to drag us back to the Stone Age.
This came the same day as Ukraine's president Oleksandr Turchynov floated the idea of a national referendum on the future of the country. On Sunday at the UN Security Council, America's ambassador Samantha Power blaming one country.
The fact is that this is the saddest kind of instability. It is completely man-made. This instability was written and choreographed in and by Russia.
Russia's ambassador, Sitali Churchkin, saying Ukraine must stop a war with its own people and that it was America that was responsible.
It is the West that will determine the opportunity to avoid civil war in Ukraine. Some people, including in this chamber, do not want to see the real reasons for what is happening in Ukraine and are constantly seeking the hand of Moscow and what's going on. That is enough.
For Monocle, I'm Phil Hahn.
The thoughts there of Phil Hahn on what we're seeing in Ukraine. James Schneider and James Boyes are with me here in Studio One in Midori House. James Boyes, if I can start with you. Interesting there, I suppose, unsurprising insights from Moscow and from the West about who's really to blame here. Are there kernels of truth in what either party there has to say?
It's kind of interesting, isn't it? It's all very reminiscent of the old Cold War scenario when we're sitting around the Security Council with the ambassador to the US and the ambassador to what was the USSR slinging barbs at one another. It isn't often, so let's make a note of this. I'm agreeing with Samantha Power. It does seem that this is a situation which has been completely authored at the Kremlin. Whatever one says about what it is that's going on in the West, the United States is not playing adventurous politics at this point. Barack Obama's entire administration is about withdrawal. It's not about confrontation. Whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, I think what it does say is that it really is not in the United States' interest to be manufacturing an incident like this in any way, shape or form in what is effectively Russia's backyard. And as a result of this, I think it's very much playing to Putin's concept of trying to emerge as a strong man in Russian history again and redress, if you will, the shift in balance of power effectively that very much occurred, I think, when people like Clinton was in power, partnering Boris Yeltsin in the Kremlin.
James Schneider, when you look at the situation we're seeing here, it's sort of often too easy, I suppose, for analysts and people looking from the outside to draw, you know, broad historical comparisons. But certainly people say, well, it does seem like that we've seen instances like this before, where it's actually very difficult for anybody to get involved in a constructive way, and that the differences are often going to have to be settled, you know, at the end of a rifle. Do you think that there's any truth in that? I mean, what can any outsiders do, do you think, when we look at this sort of theatre?
Well, the problem is, who's an outsider? I mean, so obviously everyone in Ukraine are not outsiders. Russia isn't really an outsider. The EU isn't really an outsider. And America is not really an outsider. So everybody has played a part in creating the current situation as it is. And therefore, no, not one of those elements, even though that some of them are antagonistic to one another, can be left out in coming to some kind of solution.
What if we look then, and I guess people will be fearing further escalation in the crisis, James Boyes, do you think that this could spark in something far more serious even than what we're seeing now?
Well, it would be a fool, I think, to try to suggest that nothing is impossible. Mm. I think one of the benefits of this is, you know, we need to think back why this is happening. You know, part of this is happening because of we're in the post-Cold War era in many respects, this idea that they're still trying to get some sort of a balance of power scenario going on in that part of the world. If you look at where it was that NATO expansion was pushed up to, there were people such as Charlie Kupchan, for example, who worked on Clinton's National Security Council, who were very, very mindful of if you push Western expansionism through NATO or the European Union too far east up into the gates of Moscow, effectively, you put it in the Russia's nose. At some point, not necessarily under Yeltsin, but under a future leader such as Putin, you're going to get pushback. And as a result of that, you know, you think, well, okay, where are we now? If this had been done with Ukraine as part of NATO, we'd now be at risk of trying to trigger Article 5, which would be defense of one, you know, come to the aid of everybody, effectively. So thankfully, we're not at that point. The question now is, you know, how does Ukraine survive this? Is it going to be completely consumed back under Russian control, as it looks like the Crimean region has been? Are you going to end up with divisions in the country? It's very, very difficult to tell where we're going at this point.
I mean, James Schneider, do you have any insights on that? I mean, do you think it's inevitable there will be some sort of regional breakup, or is there some way that this could be sort of held together loosely? We're hearing talks now of, you know, that there are other offers of national referendums like that we saw already in the Crimean region. Is there any prospect of that sort national, of binding this together, perhaps? Or?
Well, national referendum or enhanced devolution or greater federalism or any of these things really should be viewed not in the context of things being kept together, but the line at which Russia is happy to say we can't go any further and we're pushed back. So if you look back to the 2008 Georgian War, they went in, they saw where what was kind of acceptable and what they were able to get away with, and then stopped there and pulled back and kept South Ossetia and Abkhazia. And so we're not really talking in a kind of creative solutions on both sides trying to work out they've got, you know, differing legitimate interests, and all they're trying to do is come up with a creative solution that everyone will be happy for. There's a lot more kind of just raw fighting, not necessarily with guns, but I mean, there are those as well, to settle what is going to be the final outcome of this. It's not a kind of pleasant negotiated thing. There's negotiations taking place by Russia clearly egging on or being involved with. We don't know exactly what's going on in Donetsk and in the other towns in the southeast.
Yeah, certainly the situation in the east of the country, very unclear. James Boyce, if I can go back to what you were talking a little earlier, where you sort of alluded to the Obama appetite for, you know, these sort of foreign policy excursions. How serious do these kind of situations have to get, do you think, before anybody really in the capital is willing to say, well, hang on, surely we should get involved at some stage? Or is there simply no appetite, almost regardless of what we end up seeing on the streets anywhere throughout Ukraine?
I'm going to suggest to you that there's two points here. One is appetite, the other is political timescales. There is no great appetite within the administration to getting involved in any future deployment. It's been very much geared up to getting out of sticky situations, not getting into. That's the first point. The second is the clock's ticking. Everybody knows that there are midterm elections coming up in November this year. As soon as they're out of the way, guess what, folks? It's gearing up for the presidential election 2 years after that. That might seem like, well, hang on, that's 3 years away. Absolutely. But no American president is one suddenly getting involved in, you know, effectively putting troops on the ground face to face with our friends in Russia, effectively, in the lead up to a presidential election. So I think you're going to end up with a situation whereby Putin might get away with a lot of this because of a lack of desire in Washington and also an impending presidential election.
Let me encourage you then to do a bit of sort of crystal ball gazing, because I always find this curious, like the judgments of history. Yeah. If we, let's say we're in, I don't know, even 2020, as far ahead as that, looking back at the sort of Obama administrations, and someone says to you, well, James, you know, how did Obama fare on the world stage when it came to foreign policy? Did he do a reasonable job? What do you think, it's obviously a rather hard to say, but what do you think people will be saying, you know, when we're a few years ahead and we have that hindsight?
It'll be a mixed bag. It'll be, he'll be the president who took America out of Iraq, out of Afghanistan, couldn't close Gitmo, didn't go into Syria, didn't go into this part of the world we're talking about here. He did what was necessary, but no more. And to be quite honest, that's what you'd expect from most presidents. This is not a president who campaigned wanting to go abroad to slay dragons. He was campaigning as not George W. Bush. And as far as he's seen, he'll have done a decent job of that. He's closed down George Bush's, what he'll have seen as adventurous overseas foreign policy, and hasn't gotten America engaged overseas in a dangerous fashion as a result of any sort of misadventure.
Now, you mentioned Afghanistan there. Let's depart Ukraine and indeed head to Afghanistan. The first democratic transfer of power there underway. Votes still being counted in some places. It looks like the two front runners will be Abdullah Abdullah and Ashraf Ghani, two of probably the three most sort of fancied candidates. The presumed pick of current President Hamid Karzai is languishing in third place. A chance for a fresh start for Afghanistan. Where do you think? Where would you sort of gauge that we're at, James Schneider, in this situation in Afghanistan?
Well, positive that there will be some kind of transfer of power, and that is a good thing, seeing where the country has come from. But I don't think we should be enormously optimistic about what's taking place. So, from the kind of mainstream Western perspective, it might look rather nice that the two candidates that come up on top are highly kind of, they're technocratic guys. One who's been finance minister, one who's been foreign minister, who know how the Western system operates and how the previous military occupation worked. But look at who they've got alongside them. Look at their running mates. Look at their support structures, and it is still that tribal warlordism of the country, and really. This election, it's a good thing that's happening. It's a good thing that so far it's been, relatively speaking, relative to normal levels of violence, not too violent. But the big test is going to come. What happens to the country, which is very violent and very unstable, when the troops come out and then it really enters its new phase?
I guess that's an interesting point. And a lot of people are delighted that Abdullah Abdullah and Ashraf Ghani, whoever comes out on top, both seem to be interested in signing some sort of bilateral security agreement with the Americans. And James Boyce, it's interesting, given what you just said about Obama sort of, extricating America from this mess, that is still going to be, is it not, fundamental to the ongoing security of Afghanistan, is exactly how whoever it is in the White House within a couple of years works with either Abdullah or Ashraf Ghani, as it appears to be at the moment.
Yeah, and I don't think anybody will be too disappointed to see the current occupant out of the way, quite frankly, because it's quite clear that Hamid Karzai has been a very, very problematic partner for the West for a long time now. Let's be honest, have we got Jeffersonian democracy in Afghanistan at this point? Absolutely not. However, will there be some people down in Texas saying, "See, we can export democracy"? You know, it's
intrigues me. Do you actually think that will that play that way in some of these sort of markets?
Let's not forget. People talk about democratic promotion that George W. Bush banged on about over and over again, as though it's like a new idea. American presidents have been trying to export democracy since at least Woodrow Wilson, and maybe even before that, going back to Teddy Roosevelt. So, this idea of trying to spread democracy is very much an American idea.
A partial way, though.
Oh, it's in a very American way, absolutely. On American terms, there's no doubt about it. But, you know, it's national interest, effectively. There will be some people within the American, I hate to use the expression, neoconservative movement, who'll be looking at this and saying, well, look, you know, there's elections, there's democracy in Afghanistan. You said we couldn't do it. Here's tangible proof of it. Well, there's a degree to which you can't really argue with that. Whether we like to admit it or not, there is a democratic process going on in Afghanistan that arguably wasn't there before.
But before we move on, James Schneider, let me ask you briefly. It is interesting looking at those global perspectives on these kind of conflicts. And we usually discuss, obviously, certain sort of dynamics on the African continent with you. What do you think that if you consider maybe leadership in some of those countries where there's been various foreign, you know, interventions around the edges, what do they make of the American campaign in Afghanistan? Do you think that from the continent of Africa, people look at it and say, well, the Americans will be pleased with a job well done there? Or is there a rather healthier degree perhaps of scepticism than that?
No, I think there's quite a lot of scepticism, although the United States relative to other countries has in many countries in the African continent reasonably high kind of positive ratings. There is a feeling that the American power overreached itself and America is declining in some manner, and it's visible in kind of everyday life and everyday economic interactions. So I think it fits into the narrative very easily. America has overstretched itself, it's declined, it couldn't win this war properly, and now it's coming back, and of course it's going to put on a bit of spin to say it's all okay.
We're going to take a short break now on Midori House. With me, Tom Edwards, James Boyes and James Schneiders alongside me. And when we return, we'll discuss the deteriorating security situation in Nigeria. Amongst other things, we'll also ask whether the Republican Party is racist. Stay tuned.
The Monocle subscription package is your year-round entry into the world of Monocle. For £90, you get a year of Monocle in print. And that's 10 magazines, including two double issues and our two seasonal newspapers, Alpino and Mediterraneo. You'll get access to online archives and an exclusive tote bag designed by our in-house team and made by our friends at Rutote of Japan. Plus, free shipping to wherever you are in the world. And that's all for £90 sterling. Or you can double your fun with our two-year package for £170, which comes with two bags and our exclusive organiser. So treat yourself, or even a loved one, to a Monocle subscription, available at monocle.com.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24, 1823 here in London. Still with me are both James Boyes and James Schneider. Let's turn our attentions now to US domestic politics, specifically the Republican Party. Over the weekend, Attorney General Eric Holder went off script and said he and the president were treated differently by the Republican Party solely because of their race. It's a sentiment that was repeated by Nancy Pelosi when discussing immigration reform.
I think race has something to do with the fact that they're not bringing up an immigration bill. I've heard them say to the Irish, if it were just you, this would be easy.
Nancy Pelosi there. And on Sunday, New York Congressman Steve Israel got involved. He added to the debate. He suggested the Republican base does have elements that are animated by racism. James Boyes, I'll begin with you. Should we be surprised by at least the strength of this rhetoric? Or do you think nothing should surprise us when we sort of get into these kind of areas?
Yeah. Here's the problem. As soon as you're dealing with the first African-American president and you're opposing him, the easy card to play, the joker, if you will, is to call the race card. People are looking at this and saying, well, it's terrible. There's never been such luck a jam on Capitol Hill before. It's terrible. The system is dysfunctional. It's clearly broken. It's absolute nonsense. All this reveals is a complete lack of appreciation of about how the American system of government operates, how it's meant to operate, and how it has operated. You know, we've had presidents impeached before. No one seriously expects Barack Obama to be impeached, and yet Bill Clinton was impeached. Was that racist? I don't think so. People forget also, they portray this like, oh, you know, evil Republicans, racist, great Democrats, peace-loving, etc., etc. People forget, you know, we're talking now about the 50-year anniversary of the Civil Rights Act, when John F. Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson were trying to pass those foundation bills, the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act in 63 and 64. It wasn't Southern white Republicans that were opposing it. It was Southern white racist Democrats who were opposing it. And the way the narrative of that struggle has been told and mistold is very, very problematic. We were talking before we came on air, and there's a very famous Southern governor, for example, who tried to prevent integration at Ole Miss University. And some people might know this from the Forrest Gump movie, for example, which I hate to distinct to that level. And very recently, he was captioned on MSNBC as being a Republican. Well, he was a Democrat. And the way that he's being misspun as though, well, you know, it's an easy narrative. Lovely Democrats, peace-loving, civil rights endorsing, evil Republicans. It's a false narrative. There are people within both parties who have got issues with race. And let's not forget, it was Robert Byrd who, until not that long ago, was the senior ranking member in the Senate, who was head of the Ku Klux Klan until he died. So there are problems on both sides, just as there always are in all countries, I think.
James Schneider, what do you make of that? I mean, it is certainly intriguing that it's spun in certain ways, this sort of discussion, and the rhetoric, perhaps understandably the rhetoric, can get pretty fiery. Do you agree with James Boyser that there's probably a sort of a fundamental understanding, particularly from perhaps beyond the American shores, about exactly, you know, who stands where on the spectrum and what are the real political sort of issues involved here?
Yes, I would broadly agree with that. And of course, the United States, and I sound very English. I'm also an American citizen, so I can't be beaten up for this. Is a society that is still suffers from enormous structural racism, and there's huge amounts of statistics and sociological work and all the rest to demonstrate that. Now, race has been, or you know, there are cases where calling somebody racist has been used for political purposes, but not as often as racism has been used for political purposes either. And that, of course, there are elements of the Democrat Party as well as the Republican Party who are racist. It's probably more likely that there are more in one than the other, but that doesn't necessarily mean that all Republicans are bad and all Democrats are good. It definitely doesn't mean that. But I think we should be looking more, rather than looking at the base and what, you know, some activists who might have, you know, put some weird things up on blogs about Barack Obama, I don't think that really matters. It's more how language is used and differences constructed by elites and leaders. So there is certain kind of damaging language which can be used by seemingly kind of anti-racist leaders, like perhaps Ronald Reagan, using terminology like welfare queen, which is this kind of dog whistle politics which suggests in the mind of a reasonable number of voters who are more likely to vote for him, perhaps because of it, it's referring to black single mothers in inner cities. And I think that there's still a huge struggle against racism going on in America. And the first step before you get to a non-racial society is you make, to steal a line from Stuart Lee, adapted slightly, you make the racist cloak their inherent racism in a more inventive language.
Intriguing stuff, and I'm sure... James Boyes, eager to make a very quick point.
Talking about this, it was Nancy Pelosi's colleague, Harry Reid, for example, has reported in the very insightful book Game Change that came out looking at the 2008 campaign, who originally said of Barack Obama, this guy will be great because he'll appeal across racial lines, basically because he's kind of like the acceptable face of black America. He's got like a pallor that's not too black. He doesn't sound too black. You know, and he had to come out and apologize for this sort of tone and terminology, which is clearly inherently identifying someone on the grounds of race. And this is the Democratic leader in the Senate of the United States today, not 50 years ago, not 100 years ago, but right now.
It's not just the Republicans.
Absolutely. This is the Democrat. Yeah.
No, exactly. I agree.
I think that's probably one thing we'll all agree on. It's never anyone. They're probably all as bad as each other. Just before we run out of time on the programme, let's turn and talk about very serious news, deteriorating security situation in Nigeria, a series of blasts rocking an area outside Abuja, more than 70 killed. Authorities immediately suspect the Islamist group Boko Haram responsible. James Schneider, before you leave us, if I can just ask you about this. not the first attack we've seen in Abuja. How worried should we be that this is a serious escalation of Boko Haram's activities here?
We don't know. I mean, this attack is rather different from previous ones that have been in Abuja. There hasn't been an attack in Abuja for coming up for 3 years now. And previously, they've focused on UN headquarters, large government sites. There was an attack on a newspaper headquarters. This seems slightly different. It's difficult to say what's going to happen afterwards. I mean, Boko Haram have been mainly pushed back to their stronghold, which is in three states in the northeast of the country. And so, I mean, people are jumping to a lot of conclusions. It is the obvious conclusion to draw, but we don't know exactly what it means yet. No one's claimed responsibility. Often, Boko Haram attacks after a statement is put out, and that hasn't happened yet. So, really, we need to try to, you know, be very sorry about what's happened, and then wait and see what comes out.
Digest the situation. James Schneider, for your insights, thank you very much. James Boys as well, thank you both very much indeed for joining us today here on Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost, see on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
Plenty still to come in the second half of today's Midori House. We'll be checking in with our man in Belgrade and we'll review the best exhibitions in the art world, on the other side of the Atlantic, that is. That's all ahead. Before we begin all of that, though, let's hear from Jonathan Wheatley, who's here with the latest world news headlines.
Thank you very much. A bomb has killed at least 71 people at a Nigerian bus station 5 miles from the capital, Abuja. Suspicion has fallen on the Islamist group Boko Haram. EU foreign ministers say the destabilization of eastern Ukraine is clearly being instigated by Russia as they arrived for a day-long discussion in Luxembourg to discuss the crisis in Ukraine. Meanwhile, pro-Russian activists in the eastern Ukrainian city of Luhansk remain barricaded in the state security service building they continue to occupy in the central square. Defence lawyers for 5 men accused of conspiring in the September 11, 2001 attacks asked a judge to halt a pre-trial hearing in Guantanamo Bay in Cuba over concerns that FBI agents are investigating them. Earlier this month, 2 FBI agents apparently approached a defence team member and asked him to sign an agreement. And the search for the missing Malaysia Airlines flight MH370 is switching from the surface to the seabed of the Indian Ocean. Air Chief Marshal Angus Houston, who's in charge of the search, says an oil slick has been found inside the current search zone off Western Australia. For the moment, that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Jonathan. And Jonathan Wheatley will return with a full bulletin of world news for you at the top of the next hour. Right now, though, with the time at 21:32 in Moscow, 18:32 here in London, you're with Midori House live on Monocle 24. It's time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. Today, I'm delighted to say, we're heading to Belgrade. Joining us is our man in Serbia. It's Guy Delaunay. Guy, welcome to the programme. Very good to speak with you, as always. And we'll begin, I gather, with another of the notorious figures from the 1990s, of course, the Balkans conflict. We're always charting the career progress of various of these villains. Who are we talking about today?
We're talking about Ratko Mladic, whom people might remember was the leader, the military leader of the Bosnian Serb forces during the 1990s. And he's on trial at the International Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia in The Hague at the moment, facing all sorts of charges, the most serious of which is genocide. But he's rather hoping those charges will be dropped. He's filed a dismissal motion, easy for you to say. He's filed a dismissal motion asking that these charges be dropped. The verdict on whether the decision on whether those charges will be dropped will be announced in the morning, and that will be before his defence actually gets underway. The prosecution's already said their piece, but Ratko Mladic says he'd rather like these charges to be dismissed before he goes to the trouble of defending himself.
Now, Guy, remind us briefly with what exactly these charges deal with, and also perhaps explain to us why he thinks there are grounds then for them to be dismissed.
Yeah, the two major crimes which are covered here under this genocide charge are the siege of Sarajevo, the capital of Bosnia, in which about 14,000 people died, and then right towards the end of the conflict, and most infamously of all, the Srebrenica massacre, in which around 7,000 to 8,000 people died, including young children. And Mladic was, as I mentioned, the leader of the Bosnian Serb forces. So the court is saying, or the prosecution is saying, that as the leader of those Bosnian Serb forces, he's responsible for those deaths and for organising the genocide of those people who are Bosniak Muslims. And now Mladic is saying, well, I might have been the leader of the Bosnian Serb forces, but I certainly didn't order anybody to commit genocide. How dare you say so? And I don't believe you have the proof to accuse me of that. And he's actually saying before the court that there is insufficient evidence to prosecute him on the charge of genocide and on many of the other individual offences of which he's accused, more than 100 of them, and he's asking the court to strike those down.
Let's talk about another tribunal then, Guy. War crimes from the 1990s up for discussion in this one. Tell us about this and what the allegations are in this other case.
Now, this one's really interesting. This deals with Kosovo, which was another instance in which Serbia and Serb forces were painted out to be the bad guys in the 1990s. But of course, in all these conflicts, it's never as simple as that. Both in whether it was Bosnia, Croatia or Kosovo, there were ethnic Serb civilians who suffered greatly in those conflicts. And one of the things which Serbs have never got over really from the Kosovo conflict is the accusation that a number of Serbs were murdered and then that their organs, their internal organs were sold, were trafficked for profit by members of the Kosovo Liberation Army. And now these are allegations which have gone around for many years, and they're being taken a lot more seriously these days. The US war crimes investigator Clint Williamson is involved now, and the president of Kosovo has just said that she will ask the European Union to set up a tribunal outside of Kosovo to finally, once and for all, deal with these allegations and prosecute any people who are suspected of involvement.
Well, let's talk a little bit about those people who may be involved, Guy. I mean, are there people who are still involved in, you know, within politics, within maybe, I don't know, the current administration who are implicated in these old claims?
Well, Prime Minister Hashim Tachi, for one, he is a former political leader of the Kosovo Liberation Army. There are many people at high levels of the government in the Republic of Kosovo, which declared its independence 6 years ago, who were former members of the Kosovo Liberation Army. I mean, this is one of the uncomfortable facts of life, that the many international countries, many countries have recognised the independence of Kosovo, more than 100 of them at the last count. But they're well aware that the people involved in the government are not whiter than white, that many of them were involved in what was, during the 1990s, prescribed as a terrorist organisation, the Kosovo Liberation Army. And, of course, this is now coming back to haunt not only the international actors in all of this, but the members of the Kosovo Liberation Army themselves.
Guy, let's move on to, it's a rather different note to this story. The Queen Mother of Yugoslavia. She's been restored, I gather. Tell me more.
Indeed she has. And this is Queen Maria Karadjordjevic, who was the mother of Yugoslavia's last king, Peter II. Now, the royal family came to an extremely sticky end in Yugoslavia, as people may know. That obviously there was the Second World War, and then at the end of that, Tito took over. Yugoslavia became a socialist republic, and that was that for the royal family. And Queen Maria was stripped of her Yugoslav citizenship in 1947 and all her possessions, and she was banned from ever returning to Yugoslavia. But now a court order in Belgrade has said that that decision was actually null and void, mustn't stand, and therefore she has been restored posthumously, it must be said, to her previous glory.
And what about her? I mean, is she physically going to be restored then, or has that already happened indeed?
Yeah, it has already happened. Her remains were returned to Serbia, not Yugoslavia anymore, obviously, but to the royal mausoleum just outside Belgrade. They were returned last year and buried alongside the remains of her son and her daughter-in-law. And this is one of the bizarre things about Serbia. This is the Republic of Serbia, let's not forget. And yet you had a royal funeral here for Queen Maria and the other royals who were restored in the royal mausoleum. And there's a sort of royalish crest on the flag. So it's a slightly odd situation that we have.
It sounds a little odd. I just wonder, it seems like there's still quite a strong, I don't know, could we call it a monarchist sentiment? Could we see a return of the royals then?
I think there's an element of folk in Serbia who rather like the fact that there was a royal family here, and I think some people have the pride in the fact that Serbia has one and say Croatia doesn't. Any way to cock a snook at your neighbour I think is quite welcome. So I wouldn't put anything beyond the bounds of possibility, and there is a crown prince here, or someone who calls himself the crown prince, other people who give themselves the title Royal Highness, all of which is extremely bizarre, as I repeat, in a republic.
Absolutely. Well, let's not rule anything out then, Guy. That's our Guy Delaunay, Monocle's man in Belgrade. Thank you very much indeed for joining us on Midori House. Up next on the programme, we'll be heading to look at the fruits of the art world in Hong Kong and in New York. Stay tuned.
From cotton fields in Egypt to state-of-the-art laboratories in Bergamo, Monocle's film search for Made in Italy textiles focuses on the fifth-generation heritage firm Albini.
There is all this passion for excellence which comes from our art, from our landscape. There is really a typical Italian way of seeing things with passion for what is beautiful. And we have this in our soul. When customers see Made in Italy, they really must be sure that behind there are all these values.
The Fabric Mill, part of our Italian industry special, now playing in the film's menu on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Tom Edwards, 1841 exactly here in London. Now, throughout their career, Scandinavian artist duo Michael Elmgren and Inga Dragset have drawn attention to social politics and the status quo through the use of subversive humour in their work. For the latest exhibition in Hong Kong at Gallery Perrottin, Elmgren and Dragset revisit their interest in the dilemma of European historical identity and cultural heritage in a contemporary globalised world. Monocle's Vivian Liu met with the artists to find out how Hong Kong inspired them.
This is the first time we visit Hong Kong at all, and it's actually also our first exhibition, yeah. We kind of use Hong Kong and our idea of Hong Kong a little bit as a sort of rear view mirror back to Europe, and we're making a sort of mental image, a sort of deeply psychological and a little bit scary image of Europe as it has been.
Europe is sort of the older, very spoiled family member who always used to be the one who could decide and set the order. And after not having that role anymore, after not being the leading power in the world, European culture has turned into having a major identity crisis. They don't really know what their role is today. So it's interesting to see, of course, how the European culture will be relevant in the future. Right now, it seems that European traditions are more of a fetish or an introvert style today.
So in some ways, this exhibition, which you've titled The Old World, is a look from Asia into the European mindset.
Well, it's still how we imagine that it might be seen. It is a fiction, of course. You know, when you come up to the 17th floor here in Hong Kong, in this office building, you enter a black space now rather than the white cube gallery that you normally are used to seeing. We have placed different sort of objects, almost relics in a way, from European culture around in this space. That could be, for instance, like these mantelpieces that we have placed, fireplaces that don't, of course, function. There's like books that are wood carved, there's a white globe, there are like old letters with romantic poetry on them. We have even like a white European maid standing in the middle of the room. So it's all kind of a bit anachronistic, creating a sort of very odd atmosphere, I feel.
The exhibition is creating a whole atmosphere rather than just showing single pieces around. It's like entering a dream world. You come into otherworldly atmosphere and can walk around almost like a private detective and finding the clues, what had happened on the crime scene.
When I first walked in, it felt like walking into someone's home, and you feel slightly lost at first because there's so many pieces drawing your eye and you want to kind of get a closer look. Is that the intention for the viewer to walk in and discover for themselves?
Yeah, it's definitely the idea, and we like that people can complete the stories that we have started.
And can you highlight perhaps a couple of pieces for our listeners who may or may not have a chance to visit themselves?
We have our male version of the famous Danish Little Mermaid sitting on the stone. That is an exact replica of the stone that the Little Mermaid is sitting on in Copenhagen. And this nude young man is sitting, not looking over the sea only here, but also the skyscrapers, the new developments, the future that might be for him as well, Asian.
Another work is a baby bed, and on the edge of the baby bed there's like a sinister looking vulture looking down into the empty bed. As we all know, the vulture is only eating you when you're already dead, so it's about the beginning and the end. The beginning always leads to an end. The vulture is a feature that we have used in a lot of exhibitions, and we call it the critic. It's our own critic.
Are these works all new? Did you make them with this exhibition in mind, or are perhaps they've been shown before but you've repurposed them to this old world exhibition?
Only a few we have used before. The big head of Gustav Mahler, the bust that is there, was part of an exhibition at the Victoria and Albert Museum that we had in this autumn called Tomorrow. And other pieces have been shown in different versions before, but most of the works are completely site-specific and dedicated to this.
And you've worked together for nearly 20 years now. When you come up with a new exhibition, is it one of you has the idea and then you build on that, or what's the creative process like for you?
No, our creative process is based on an ongoing dialogue, like a dialogue that has been going on for 20 years, so it's a long one. It's not that we take turns coming up with ideas for exhibitions, it's really based on the discussions we have. And of course, when you have done one exhibition, it inspires you to do another exhibition. So, like, this is a natural continuation of the show we did at the Victoria and Albert Museum.
And will we see a continuation of this show, perhaps in the near future?
Possibly. I mean, the next show in this region is the show that we're doing at the Plateau Samsung Museum in Seoul next year. So we're going over there, and after this trip to Hong Kong and to see what inspires us there.
That was Michael Elmgreen and Inga Dragset speaking to Monocle's Vivian Liu on their latest exhibition in Hong Kong. This is Midori House. In a moment, we'll be heading to New York for a look at what exhibitions are causing headlines in the art world. Before we do, no time for some music. The perfect song for Phil Hahn, I think. It's Englishman in New York by Sting. That was Englishman in New York by Sting. Let's go to New York next on Midori House. Monday here in London, that's when we review the best of art from around the world. And I'm delighted to say that joining us from our New York bureau with her review on the top exhibitions there is Charlotte Burns, news editor with the Art Newspaper. Charlotte, welcome to Midori House. Great to speak to you, of course. Where shall we start our wander through the New York art scene? Perhaps at MoMA. Tell us what we'll find there.
MoMA just opened a new exhibition of works by Sigmar Polka, which is the first comprehensive retrospective taking in all the media across which he worked. It's also one of the largest shows in MoMA's history, and to my mind, one of the best. It's absolutely fantastic. Everybody should go and see it. It's sort of really just a refreshing, exciting, thought-provoking, and, you know, good to look at exhibition.
That certainly sounds, that's a pretty enthusiastic endorsement. Now, we know a lot of these MoMA shows, they often have they've got a lot of space, they have a huge number of works. Is that, do we really capture the complexity and the mix of Polka's career? Because it's so sort of influential, so many, it turned the hand so much to so many different things.
He did, absolutely. And I don't think the range of his work's ever been truly covered in an exhibition, because he himself, you know, sort of shied away from any kind of simple answers about anything, let alone his work. So this exhibition has taken I think 2 years in the making at least, and the effort that's gone into it is apparent. It's really well organized, and if anything, it just brings across the idea that Polka wanted things to contaminate, you know, this working across a range of media. You don't really need a narrative in his work, because there's the joy of the exhibition and of his output is that there's a million narratives you can take, because he was constantly lambasting one thing, starting up with another. It's very witty, it's very experimental, he's very skeptical. Some parts you laugh out loud, you know, other parts you're, you know, looking at, you know, his experiments when he was high on LSD and magic mushrooms. It's kind of runs the gamut, really, and is very exciting because of that. Some of the best art I think I've seen for some time.
Well, that's certainly, I wonder whether we've peaked too soon, Charlotte. This is what I worry now. Where are we going to go next? Can anything measure up to that show? What else have you got for us?
Well, I'm going to take us back in history for the next show, and actually Germany again. At the Neue Gallery uptown in New York, they have an exhibition, which is a historic show called Degenerate Art, The Attack on Modern Art in Nazi Germany, 1937. This is a very important show because it documents the exhibition Entartete Kunst, which is degenerate art, the exhibition that the Nazis put on in 1937. When Hitler came into power, one of the first things he did was try and dismantle contemporary culture. And he was, you know, successful in doing this. He, you know, within months of being elected, he had, you know, made his own Reich culture chamber. They were burning books, dismissing teachers, replacing them with their own preferred candidates, and really pushing forward this idea of degeneracy, which was that some people are inherently, you know, atavistic and criminal, which is, you know, largely has definite racist overtones, you won't be surprised to hear, bearing in mind it's a Nazi exhibition. And this show is a huge turning point. It's also, you know, an opportunity to see some works which haven't been put together for a while. It's a fairly small show, but it is the first major US show of works from this degenerate art exhibition since LACMA did a show in 1991. So it's a rare opportunity to see these things. The show was so important because the Nazis took over a space and pulled together loads of works from all the leading contemporary artists, George Grosz, Otto Dix, Nolde, the Die Brücke group, and hung them in this chaotic way and, you know, wrote labels saying, look at what they've done to the German woman, and blah, blah, blah. You know, all this kind of thing, sort of lambasting their work and criticizing it and saying how un-German it was, sort of inferior Jewish Bolshevik work. So, and across the way, they had, the opposite. They're kind of, I forget the name of it, the sort of German view of good art, this much more conservative work. And the Neue Gallery has some of those works on show as well. So you can see the contrast in the sort of official style, which is very classical, and the contemporary style.
It must be a sort of fascinating contrast between the two. I just wondered, obviously, some of the artists whose names you mentioned there have been very much back in the public focus of late, because we've seen these extraordinary troves of sort of rediscovered lost masters. Many of, I wonder, did some perhaps even feature in the original show? But some of these pictures that were presumed lost, you know, for forever. And that's really sort of piqued people's interest, hasn't it, all around the world. Do you think that's maybe one of the things that's galvanized people to sort of look at afresh at some of these works?
Well, their timing, I think, was just, you know, sort of luck for the Neue Gallery, because they obviously have been planning this for some time. But it is, you know, a great coincidence, because obviously people are reassessing the situation once again. In the art world, it's been a major issue for decades, because so many people lost work, and it's a very thorny issue of how you decide what a forced sale was. That's the thing with the Gerlitworks, which were discovered in Munich. He says that some of them were not forced, that people sold the works to him willingly. How do you assess that when someone's being sent to a concentration camp, whether a sale is forced or not? So it's a very difficult situation. To prove provenance is one thing, to prove the rightful heirs, and for this huge cache of works to be discovered is unheard of. I don't think there's anything like that, because more it's been people tracking things down, trying to trace where these works went. And, so many of them are still missing. Lots were destroyed. And they have an exhibition, part of the exhibition actually, are these empty frames, which is quite moving because they're all these frames that that Mr. Lauder, who's a backer of the Neue Gallery, he bought them back and sort of hung them. They're quite poignant because it's, sort of representative of all the works which were lost, hanging alongside, works which we have rediscovered.
It sounds a very arresting shot, definitely another one to track down. Let's move on, though. We're a little short of time, so I wanted to ask you about Veil. Tell me a little bit about this one. I know this is a forthcoming show, but tell us why we should be marking our cards for this one.
Well, first of all, we finally have nice weather in New York, so it's a good time to be going outside. Winter has finally passed, so it's time to catch the train and go to Connecticut to Philip Johnson's Glasshouse. It's the 65th anniversary of the Glasshouse, and it's the first site-specific project to engage with the house itself. This artist, Fujiko Nakaya, has created a work called Veil. It's going to open on the 1st of May, running through till the end of November. And what's interesting about this is that the Glasshouse is the famed building by Philip Johnson, his private residence on 47 acres of land, where it's totally transparent, pretty much. There's obviously some supporting wood structures, but the building is something you can see through into the nature. And so the artist is toying with that by creating this installation where every hour for about 10 to 15 minutes, a veil of fog will rise up around the house, wrapping it in this dense mist, and sort of toying with this idea of opacity and transparency and inside and outside. And also the Glasshouse is on a promontory overlooking a valley, so subject to weather change. So you'll see wind, for example, which you can't normally see, and things that you can normally see, such as the house, will become invisible.
It sounds extraordinary. That's Fujiko Nakaya Veil, and am I right to think it starts on the 1st of May, is that right?
1st of May, yep.
Another one to definitely mark our cards down. Charlotte Burns, news editor with the Art Newspaper, thank you so much for joining us, as always. Really great shows, it sounds like, in New York, and it's on Veron's. We'll have to track them down. And that is all we have time for on today's Midori House. My thanks to James Boyes and James Schneider. And today's show was produced by Phil Hunt. Thanks to him. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Sarah Fournier. Our studio manager was Bill Luti. Culture is up next. Midori House is back at the very same time tomorrow. That's 1800 hours London time, as if you needed reminding. Goodbye for now.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world-famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.